Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today, I'm sitting down with Minka Taharka, an artist, poet, farmer, and organizer. Minka grew up in Limerick Park, deepened her understanding of ecology and urban planning in the Bay Area, and spent a year living and farming in Ghana, and ultimately is now in Fresno doing the same work. She serves as coordinator for the CaliFarmer Justice Collaborative and director of land and programming with the Butterfly Movement. And her front yard is even a homestead. In this episode, we get into food apartheid and what real agricultural equity could look like in the Central Valley, the spirituality of working the land, what homesteading means when you're doing it with integrity rather than doing it for content, and why a farmer who puts a seed in the ground is by definition an optimist about the future. Let's meet Minka Taharka.
Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best. Fresno's best.
So, Minka, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
I really like to go to Heirloom. It's a delicious, quick, fresh food eatery. I feel like it has a great, it's great for people watching. Also, it has a great mixture of elders, youth, families, and I enjoy that part of experiencing going out to eat.
It is crazy how they've maintained this line and everything. It's very clear that they need another one, probably.
Yeah.
But I don't know what that would do to the current one, if it would dilute it or it would just continue to expand, because it seems like people love it. And what I find most useful for Heirloom is when I have people visiting from out of town, where you have a lot of picky people, you need a lot of different things.
So exactly.
I like that part of it.
And they have a couple of sister restaurants. So they have the Maid, the Mediterranean.
I also love that place, too.
And then I think they just opened up a new sister spot that's like more of a cafe or something.
Oh yeah, Other Side.
Yeah, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's also very
good. I haven't tried it yet.
Yeah, they know what they're doing.
And like, I see why they're like driving that sort of balance between competition but also like exclusivity, but it's also open to everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're going to talk about a number of different things. I want to start, where are you from? Tell me, what gives Limerick Park its identity?
Ooh, that is a great question. Limerick Park is a cultural hub. I actually recently saw pictures of me as like a two-year-old, like just starting to walk on the streets of Degnan, which is one of the main boulevards that Limerick Park houses, as this kind of L-shaped area of shops, and like between shops and like venue space and just like little clothing stores, little knick-knack shops. So many things have come and gone in Limerick Park, but I think what remains some of the root of it is like the park itself, first of all, which is on 43rd and Crenshaw, and the drum circles, the dancing, the like the art walks, the people is what makes Limerick. The vendors, people come to Limerick all the time, really, but especially during moments in history that have really been anchored at Limerick Park. So it's a gathering space. When you want to know what's up, you go to Limerick.
Do you think it's, because it's got like it's a pocket, and it seems like it has much more of a distinct culture identity than some of the bigger surrounding kind of cities in the area. What do you attribute that to? Is it people that live there? Is it its design? Is it, my understanding is that it's like a very cultured, art-focused community. Like, what do you think holds it together?
When we think of Los Angeles as this like larger, broader context, Los Angeles is, I don't really use this phrase that often, a melting pot, but there's a lot of people in LA. There's a lot of people and a lot of different people in different parts of LA. And Limerick Park is South Central Los Angeles. So a large concentration of Black and Latino families that have been living there for several decades. And Limerick Park in particular, it's a key place for Pan-African community development and has historically been very rooted in very revolutionary liberatory thought processes and practices that are sometimes sort of the antithesis to what Los Angeles might be like considered as, especially depending on who you're talking to. A lot of times LA is seen as the like Hollywood, and it's either Hollywood in the actual place of Hollywood, or then you see like movies like Boys to the Hood or any other number of movies that are rooted in like the Crenshaw area, which is right where Lemert Park is based in. So I think what makes it so different is, yes, the people, the way that it's been perceived, the way that it also is intentionally portrayed by the people who are from there, as well as people who are not from there, who also see some of the novelty components, which, I mean, there's obviously pros and cons to that, but I think it's fluctuated over time. I'm really curious at this particular moment, as we're gearing up towards the World Cup, as we're gearing up towards the Olympics, the way that community development and neighborhood change, gentrification has all played into the way that the imagery and storytelling of the space is done. Mm-hmm.
How do you think your understanding of ecology, the environment, your relationship to it evolved from earlier days in Los Angeles and then as you transitioned to the Bay Area? How do you think that evolved? Can you track it for us?
I can. I have a distinct memory and moment of when I was 17 or 18. It was 2012, and the Explorer. Rocket situation.
Yeah, something in space.
Yeah, and it was being moved. And so it was coming down Crenshaw. It was this big moment where everybody was like, get ready to see the Explorer. And the thing that was so exciting is like everybody was really juiced to see this thing coming down Crenshaw. But what I remembered as someone who, like, I caught the bus to school at Crenshaw High School. I actually was bused all the way out to Cleveland High School in Reseda.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is a different story.
How long on a bus was that?
2.5 hours.
Jesus.
Yeah. It was a very interesting decision and transition for me as a high schooler trying to figure out, like, where am I going to go to school and what does that look like? Which I can speak more to later, perhaps. But living in LA, living in Lemert Park at that time, living on Crenshaw, knowing that this Explorer was coming down and the preparation that the city actually did beforehand, I remember they had cut down all the trees on Crenshaw. And I remember being very sad about that because Crenshaw is a really wide street on that part, particularly where I lived at the time was 48th. And so from there to Slauson, Florence, there was a lot of trees that lined the middle island that used to exist there. And there was a process that the city took to cut down the trees so that the Explorer could move past. What that signaled to me, because at the same similar time, within about maybe 2 to 3 years, I was also going to community college way down Crenshaw at El Camino College. Mm-hmm. And at that location on Crenshaw and Vernon, they were also starting infrastructural building for what now lives there, one of the metro lines. And I just remember standing there smelling the like tar and just like fumes from their development. And that kind of alerted me to this topic of environmental justice as I was working with the community rights campaign in that was actually housed in K-Town. And so what I noticed was this relationship between communities and their environments and how and who determines that relationship, when, and just as I was just walking around as a citizen, like what am I noticing and who was responsible for making those changes? And from my relationship to those trees to my relationship to the pollution in the air. So I feel like that was a moment that I really noticed myself asking those questions in terms of my relationship to the ecology, like from the species level, and also just like my environmental, social environmental experience.
We're going to talk in a little bit about your kind of role as like organizer, administrator of some of these programs, but I want to jump just into agricultural questions and just rip through a bunch of them. So do you think one possible solution to food deserts or food apartheid is better transportation networks?
I do, because I think that the data shows how the exhaust and pollution from vehicles and vehicular transport drastically increases the amount of air pollution, and how if we had more walkable cities, more public transportation available for folks, the need to be driving mostly like one person vehicles would decrease at a very high level. And so knowing that transportation is also a key way that communities have also been changed in terms of like their layouts and the way that people engage with their like lived environment, of course, there's a direct correlation to how people experience their food systems and how that is like deeply rooted in the transportation systems.
You're working now on agricultural equity issues. Mm-hmm. So when you're thinking about that agricultural equity issues, mm-hmm. justice yes. you're working on now, what are the knock-on effects of increased equity in terms of the output from the farming world? What mm-hmm. will we be producing different things? Mm-hmm. I think as a primary benefit, making sure that the farming world is more equitable is a benefit of itself. But I'm asking beyond that, like mm-hmm. what will we see change in terms of output?
That's a very multi-layered conversation and goes to the question that you asked before, namely because I have farmers who I'm working with right now who the amount that they are able to produce and how much that they're able to sell is also related to this transportation component. Largely because, for example, I have a farmer who like drives from Fresno to SF pretty much on a weekly basis. And yes, there are markets there in San Francisco for them, but they had to rally to get funds for a refrigerated truck to be able to transport their produce. Now, in an equitable system, they would be able to sell from the place that they are in, right?
Yeah.
But there are clearly barriers that are not allowing them to get to make as much money from what they sell in place versus transporting that produce several hours north. To me, from that example, there's a clear discrepancy in the access points, the infrastructural supports. And so when I think about then what does increased equity look like? It's like there's a lot of different areas that we can increase equity. We can increase equity in the business development support for these small farmers that need more audience to know about their produce so that folks can take some of this, what's that word? Buzzword of buy local, eat local. Yeah. There's a lot of local farmers that just don't have the audience that they would need. So they're like, I don't have the funds to develop a logo to pay for a marketing team. So I got this person in San Francisco, so I'm gonna just go there because I don't have time to do the other piece. But then I'm like, what is the difference between all the time that it takes to like the gas it takes to put into that refrigerated truck, the time it takes to come back, the money you spend on buying yourself food as you're driving your food there? It just, there's a lot of layers. Yeah.
When I look at the agricultural world, I see a lot of hope in organic agriculture, regenerative agriculture. When you look at that world from your perspective vantage point, what do you see as hopeful in that world and what still concerns you with how that space operates?
Some of the ways that there's a splitting hairs component when it comes to some of our lingo around regenerative agriculture, permaculture.
I'm asking about permaculture next. That's perfect.
I've got
Gaia's Garden on my bookshelf, but we'll talk about that in a second.
And so it becomes this is one of my biggest pieces. And at California Farmer Justice Collaborative, CFJC, we are very mindful, especially on what are the definitions that we're using to talk to within our community and outside of our community, because half the time we think we're talking about the same thing, but because we're using these words, but the definitions don't mean the same thing. And so ideally, I definitely have hope when it comes to speaking of these concepts because of the way that I perceive them. And I really think that it matters to take the time to make sure that we're on the same page while we're having these large discussions, because especially on the legislative level, they dive into the definitions and they describe them according to ways that make most sense for the process that will be then operationalizing them. So for me, I sometimes will use all those words interchangeably to see which one hits whatever intended audience I have, and tend to lean towards like traditional ecological knowledge, indigenous practices, because I've been able to see a thorough line of how a lot of communities who have that relationship to land stewardship are pulling on knowledge that some of their ancestors may have been practicing. Maybe it was an ancestor of their own or an ancestor of someone who taught them how to engage with the land. And so there's this very esoteric relationship to our framing of organic or generative permaculture from like the consumer end to the producer end. So I'll stay leaning on the hopeful aspect, though, that it can provide some areas of illumination for community members and how they're interacting with their food systems, ultimately.
That makes a lot of sense. In grad school, I was a permaculture dork. I had a cute little house in Altadena where I was working on a mini berm, just stupid shit. Not that stupid, but I was half doing it as, oh, I can do a little miniature version, as opposed to leaning in. Mm-hmm. Often you have to lean in to really do it. And that's kind of my question. So it's something like permaculture, where it's a really complicated process and involves a lot of investment. Do you see that as a tool to move agriculture forward, or do you see that more as like pockets of testing ideas rather than something that can be scaled?
I'm just laughing because what came to my mind was, I don't know if you're a fan of The Office at all.
Of course.
One of my favorite problematic shows. But there's this one of the episodes where Dwight says an acronym that he lives by is KISS, Keep It Simple, Stupid.
Yeah.
And to me, that is a lot of what like nature's wisdom teaches us. Right. And I say nature's wisdom intentionally here because I also have been working with the Biomimicry 3.8 Institute, and I was part of a 2-year cohort on something called the Nature of Trust. And we really went in with other cohort members from different sectors on what is the nature of trust, and established this relationship to these different principles of what trust looks like. And now, maybe being, let's say, maybe 6 months out from completing the period where we were working together more intentionally, and now there's a toolkit and report out that we can share later, I think that it's actually really simple. Like, permaculture is really simple to an extent. There's a lot that is, there's a perception of like complexity that is inherently there based on all the zones. And it's like complex. And there's also a layer of one of my favorite parts of permaculture is it depends.
Yeah.
Like, your local context is really critical to assess before you decide to like imprint a process onto this space. Like, me living, like where you're living versus me living at my house, we're going to have different contexts.
Just microclimates.
Exactly. And so I think that where we run into an issue, and I use issue in quotes, is just because a lot of our production system does not like so many variables.
No.
So it needs like precision.
Yeah. And keep it simple, stupid in the other direction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like, no, we need conformity. We need sameness. We need consistency to a level that's just really not, it doesn't lend itself very well to the ways that the earth actually works. There's a reason why we have seasons and cycles of things. And it's very funny when you try to stick a circle and a square
Yeah.
And you're like, why won't it go? And I think that's a larger,
conversation, yeah, for sure. As someone that works in agricultural spaces, what are your kind of general thoughts about how much we should attempt to lean into rewilding land?
I think that is a very smart decision, just because when we even just take the last thing we were discussing, and again, things go through cycles. And so that means that there needs to be a period of rest, a period of production, a period of observation, a period of experimentation. And to be able to cycle through those different phases definitely depends, but each of them are necessary for a particular reason. Even the scientific method offers phases. So it's like, yeah, why wouldn't we use that same structure when it comes to land? Rewilding is an interesting concept. And I think I'm just focusing on the semantics of the word wilding.
Yeah, yeah. There's some problem at table. Problem aside, whatever the fucking
whatever the word is.
Yeah, that we need to do in order to think about what we're actually doing, because we're seeking some element of control.
Yes, right? Exactly. And I think that is just part of this like conundrum that we exist in on a very like very human level that is hard to, quote unquote, overcome. And I think that on a base level, rewilding is really, it makes sense, especially based on the context that we're in right now of like when we are living in urban areas that have been dewilded, whatever.
Yeah.
Use that. So then rewilding makes sense based on what we have to work with. So yeah, then it becomes, what does rewilding look like in that context? Like, where do you even start, right? With the pockets of soil that you have available to you? Are we breaking up concrete like some activists and organizers have done in the past and are continuing to do in many places? Yeah, there's a lot of conversations around like power and privilege that go into that as well.
Who decides what? Yeah.
Exactly.
One more question on this subject. In reading about the work you do, I often see the word spirituality brought up into it. I have lots of friends that have green thumbs, are urban farmers, and are not religious, wouldn't consider themselves deeply spiritual. Mm-hmm. How would you describe what's going on when you're having experiences of spirituality in your connection with the land to someone who's not, doesn't have those priors or those assumptions?
That is I love this question, because I think that my connection to the land, it really embodies what spirituality means to me. Especially for context, I didn't grow up in a household that practiced any one religion. So there was this metaphysical approach to how we see ourselves in the world in relationship to others, like really studying multiple religious contexts and finding like thorough lines that kind of hint to different components of sameness, but upon interpretation and our humanness of needing to be right, a lot of that has maybe shown up differently. And so for me, like working with the land, working with nature feels very like inherent. There's this process happening that like really is not up to me. So when I put it in relationship to some of the ways that religion has been posed to us as like a larger concept of society, I'm like, I can put that seed in the ground and be like, grow seed, grow, do your thing. Or I can pray for the seed to grow. But ultimately, I have to watch the seed. I've got to water it. I also have to go about my business and do whatever and come back to the seed. But the seed is doing its own thing that is pretty much independent of me. And that in itself like is a process of trusting this other situation that's going on that I don't necessarily need to know about, which I feel like it feels like a very applicable way of, you can call it spirit, you can call it trust, you can call it a lot of different things, but it feels appropriate for me to call it part of my spirituality as a way of understanding the way that that nature works. And to me, I feel like that's like sufficient for someone that like lives in this body on this earth right now.
Yeah, I agree. We're going to jump into my favorite section of this podcast. Okay. It's called Overrated versus Underrated. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to throw a ton of things at you.
Okay.
And just we're going to rapid fire. You tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why.
Okay.
Are you game?
I'm game.
Okay. So the first one, gray water recycling systems, over or underrated?
Underrated, actually.
Underrated. Yeah. Okay. So more people should do it. Why?
Yes. I think that it forces us to think about what products we're using, what, like on our bodies, on our surfaces, like on our dogs, on our plants, obviously our plants, because
we're kind of not in front of us.
Which is sometimes some things that we don't think about as much. And it's the reason why we have like entities like the Center for Environmental Health and like Proposition 65 and all these different things that are trying to hold different companies accountable for the chemicals that they're using to quote unquote clean. And it's actually poisoning us and affecting our endocrine systems. Mm-hmm. And then people are having these issues that are affecting them later in life, or like random rashes and things, you know, like
lower and lower incidence rates of cancer.
Gray water systems are important because they help us think twice about the things that we're using, which I think when we think about this, like consumer's responsibility.
Yeah.
And I really believe that there's a sort of imbalance in the responsibility of the companies that are creating these products that people are using. A lot of them are actually, they're benefiting from people not really caring or thinking about or having the capacity to even think about. A lot of people go and they're like, I'm going to buy this because it's the cheapest option, or because my mom swore by this brand, so I'm going to keep using it. So then it becomes this, that's what I want to distinguish between. If there were more focus on how to systemize or operationalize some of these like climate smart solutions that made it so that the people who are most vulnerable in our society could practice them, which are the majority of people who utilize a lot of the systems that are being offered to people, it would change the way the conversation is being had versus it just being like, yeah, we should just all opt in to blah, blah, blah. And it's like a lot of us are not really opting in. We're being fed certain things. So it becomes this like perceived chicken and egg situation when it actually requires some like higher level assessment and touch points, which is not always that popular.
I agree. Next one. This is a Fresno staple that I'm sure you've become familiar with. Me and Ed's Pizza.
Huh. I've never had it.
Never had it. So it's probably overrated in that respect. Next one. Alice Waters.
Alice Waters.
The edible schoolyard woman with Chez Panisse in Berkeley.
Yes, exactly. Unpopular opinion, maybe a little overrated.
Okay, why?
I think that sometimes in this, and not just exclusive to this field, but sometimes people are over-celebritized. And not to discount the work that Alice Waters and Edible Schoolyard and the impact that it has had on communities, I think that if there's one thing to know for me, I'm going to keep talking about power and privilege and the way that it bleeds into everything that we do. And just speaking on certain ways that program, that philosophy has also utilized a lot of other traditional teachings from a lot of like folks of color who are not as, their voices are not as prolific. And just thinking about like how we share, first of all, how we work within cooperative and collective systems, and wanting to make a way for the little guy, quote unquote, make a way for communal support systems. And so really just like noting the way that sometimes celebrity or notoriety can be used also as a tool of tokenism to take away from the core essence of something. Because even though I know that a lot of people are really excited and still about Edible Schoolyard and the work that Alice Waters has done, I think that there's also some ways that the project and the process and the information that I was looking to uplift has not gone as far as it needs to, because people have lost the plot a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next one, YIMBYism, Yes in My Backyard.
Yes, in my I'm so glad you said that. And it's underrated, actually, because I think that people's interests and passion is to me, I'm a very passionate and intense person. about a lot of things in all directions. And I think that YIMBYism, we should talk about it more. I think we talk about a lot about the NIMBYs and how we like be strategic about NIMBYism. But I also feel like the path of least resistance, if there's things that people don't want to buy into, maybe they don't have to buy into them. And that's okay. And the people that do will. And then it's like, how do you make space for people's different interests and desires without feeling like you've got to shame someone for not doing something or for doing something? Yay to YIMBYism.
Next one, a weird one, Emeryville.
This is a weird, underrated. I love Emeryville.
I love career bumps.
It's overshadowed by its big brothers, Berkeley.
Yeah, and Oakland.
And it's this quaint little pocket right next to the bay. And I think it's adorable.
And there's this little walking path situation right over there by the freeway, like Best Buy and stuff. It's so quaint.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Next one, sheet mulching.
I love sheet mulching. I swear by it.
Why should people do more sheet mulching?
Because it's a...
Maybe describe what it is, because it's not intuitive.
So sheet mulching, there's like a lasagna layer process of using cardboard, mulch, soil.
Some like wood or
something.
Or whatever the technical term is.
I largely use cardboard, some soil, and mulch as my lasagna layers.
And then you keep stacking
them. And I keep stacking them. And what it has helped me do is reduce the amount of weeds that grow in my yard and also build the soil through the decomposition of the sheets.
You know what I was going to ask you next? Whether you thought weeds were over or underrated. Because I remember I went to this event in Berkeley, actually, where these guys were preparing weed salads from weeds they had picked on streets in Oakland. And I was a little nervous about it. I've spilled a beer or two on the street. I've seen people poop on the street or whatever.
Yeah.
I was like, make sure we wash the weeds first. But what do you think about weeds? Do weeds get a bad rap?
They do, because weeds are all about perceptions. Who's considering what a weed and why? And a lot of weeds that I've seen... Namely, one of my favorites is dandelion, which is such a powerful medicinal herb that I was like, wow, to call dandelion a weed is really... Dandelion root to the flower, like dandelion is just such an amazing, has such amazing medicinal properties. I feel like that's one of the main weeds that changed my perception.
Great tea, too.
It's amazing tea.
Yeah.
And I use it often. And so I actually just did some harvesting of the dandelions in my yard because it's a very resilient plant as well. So weeds are overrated because you should actually just know what grows where you are so you can identify it.
Okay. Next one. Synthetic fertilizers.
I'm going to say underrated in the sense that I think we should pay more attention to synthetic fertilizers. Partly for the reason, mainly for the reason that they are synthetic. And just to me, the use of synthetic material is not very sustainable or regenerative for our environment on a long-term level, which is usually a decision made based on like metrics and quickness over, is this really...
You can industrial produce synthetics versus compost, is it just takes time.
Exactly.
Next one. Does Ghana have the best jollof rice? I have a Nigerian friend who would differ, so.
Listen, this is going to get me in trouble.
Okay, go ahead. Fire away.
I really like Ghanaian jollof, so I'm going to say that it's underrated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you would side with the Ghanaese version of it versus the other ones.
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. And you did live there. The next one from your hometown, the Vision Theater.
Oh, it is underrated, and it's gone through an amazing process of renovation. LA Commons, an awesome organization that kind of started me on my like art journey to a process, to a point, just revealed a beautiful mural in front of there. I was able to perform there with the children's theater group that my parents started called Kids of 43rd Place. And we were able to perform at the Vision, which now that I think about it, I'm like, it wasn't really being used, but somehow during that event, we were able to perform outside and inside of it. And just being able to go into a historical space like that always stuck with me. And I'm really interested to see how the next generation of youth and like our actresses and artists can engage with that space.
We're going to transition out of overrated versus underrated. I'm going to ask you a few questions about homesteading. Can you do homesteading just as a hobby, or do you need to like fully commit to truly do it?
That is a very interesting question, actually.
Do you know what I'm getting with that? Because the concept behind homesteading is that you're creating a system that's for sustenance, you know, almost like a sibling to subsistence farming in some ways. But some people like to just dip in. Can you like just dip in?
It depends.
Okay. That's the perfect answer. Yeah.
I think that you, depending on who you are and where you're at and what you like, what you know how to do, I say dip in because there's like a certain amount of pacing, right? Depending on what you have access to. And so I feel like if you have a lot of inputs available to you to really dive into homesteading, then I would say go for it. If you don't really know what homesteading is, but you're looking to start, then I would say dip, because then you can see like to what extent homesteading matches what your purposes are. Like, you have people who are like, I have a garden and I'm gonna get like a dehydrator and a freeze dryer and I'm gonna start my food, like my food stockpiling. And that's one angle of homesteading, and there's a lot of angles, so I'd say dip and dabble.
There are a lot of homesteaders on YouTube. You could, if you just type in homesteading in your search bar, you're gonna get probably hundreds.
Yeah.
How do you think about privilege and using tech tools to promote a lifestyle, to in some ways to generate revenue through views, and actual homesteaders that are just trying to pursue it for the sake of its own? Like, how do you, where is the homesteading, what does a homesteading universe look like right now?
Well, that's a good question, especially in the age of social media that we're in, just like media awareness and utilizing media as a tool to not just spread a message, but also to make money. And whenever we bring money into the equation, of course, the situation shifts. And so then talking about the power and privilege of it all is very fascinating to me, seeing like the kind of lifestyles that people are able to live based on, and then like how they're able to practice that homesteading. Like, for example, you have Nara Smith, I believe her name is. I'm not following Nara Smith, but I've seen a lot of discourse around Nara, and just like this idea of like trad wife.
I've seen things like articles that are like exposés where they're like, they're pretending to be homesteading, but they've got like a fleet of employees doing a lot of the work for them.
And see, this is part of the piece that is so fascinating to me, because I'm like, if you're gonna be homesteading for clicks, that means that you're like, okay, I'm putting this on a timeline. I've got to have certain content out by X date, which changes the way that you're engaging with the process of homesteading, which means that there's most likely going to be less time for observation, less time for experimentation in order to perhaps portray a certain version of homesteading based on your quote unquote brand. And those metrics say that having this brand that is curated is going to get you more views, which is going to bring you in more revenue. And if you're making this your job, if it's your job, that means you need a certain amount of stability. Versus if it's your hobby, you can record whenever you like. You still may have a cadence, but it may not be as, there might not be the same amount of urgency. And so then
you're just describing the podcast that you're doing right now. I'm not here for the clicks. So the resources, I'm just sharing good work that people are doing.
Exactly.
That's all I'm doing.
To me, that is what, and that is why, shout out to DJ Mr. Leonard, first of all, because I feel like that is something that I expressed to him very early on when I met him, and the integrity of it all. And I think that I don't know how this may sound, but I feel like we're in a shortage of integrity. And I think that it's very easy to be in that shortage because of the, what's the word? Maybe the bravado or the like, the focus on what you can see, the imagery, like needing to portray a version of you that's like more accessible, more likable, versus the version of you that's true and just exists without fear. And I think that's a very like broad description, but I think that it keys into some of the reasons why people are doing the things that they're doing and why some of those exposés can even be happening, which feels really wild to me. And so I don't really follow it that closely, to be honest.
It's just so stupid. Let me ask you this. What do you think are the upward limits on homesteading in an urban environment? Like, it's like what? Because a lot of homesteaders that I'll follow online, they're like outside of the city. So they have more land they have access to. So they can do things at a slightly larger scale. And then cities, you've got zoning issues. You've got all sorts of stuff going on. So for you, like are there ceilings or like things that prevent you from fully leaning into homesteading in an urban environment?
Let me tell you a story.
Okay, love stories.
So I have a front yard garden and I lived here for a year before I put the front yard garden in because when I moved
on. Is this a Karen story? Because I have a Karen question later. Yes. So you're just going to answer two questions in one.
Okay,
perfect.
And I lived here for a year because I wanted to observe. One of the main principles of permaculture, I was like, let me observe. What are people doing? And I noticed that like without living in a gated community that has like an HOA, everybody kept their yards a certain way. And as an environmentalist, I believe in ecosystem development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that includes being in an urban area. And I have had my garden in now 2 years. Now, just earlier this year, I got 2 notices from the city saying like complaint had been made and that they were identifying my space as a wildlife habitat.
No.
And I was like, oh.
That's almost a compliment.
It really is, because in the time that I've been there, I've seen so many native bees and butterflies. I've seen foxes come and go. I've seen a fox grow up. Okay.
It's adorable.
And I'm like, me and the fox, like I don't hang out with the fox, but I'm glad that it feels comfortable being able to come around. And to me, that is part of like my personal responsibility right now as a steward of the earth. And so I got those reports. The person from the city told me, oh, I wasn't sure what this was about. And I even checked to see if you were certified as a natural wildlife, wildlife habitat. And I was like, wait, you can get certified?
For your front yard?
Yes. So what did I do? I found out how to get certified. And I did get certified. And I just got my little banner in the mail.
Crazy.
That I'm about to hang in front of my house. Because at the same time,
right back to the city. Thank you, Karen, for helping me get certified.
And you know what's great is that I don't even... it's a Karen, whatever. But at the same time, I know that people don't know what they don't know.
Yeah.
And so part of what my excitement is for these like next stages that I'm moving into as someone who has a garden space, a budding community space, is, and something I do in some of the other areas of my work through like our Sankofa Gardens program. This is a Sankofa garden. So that is a program that the Butterfly Movement started in 2020 as like this homage and kind of this cousin to Victory Gardening, of building gardens where people are at, to support their journeys towards homesteading, their journeys mm-hmm. towards learning how to grow food. What does that look like? How do you do that in an urban space? And so it wasn't, obviously my parents were like, are you sure you can do this? You can turn your front yard into a, I was like, I'm going to do it and see what happens. And so.
It is true though, what you're saying about, you could reduce the story to a Karen situation and create a villain. And I generally think people are victims and villains at the same time. And their villainy is often victimizing themselves in ways, and they're hurting themselves without realizing. And that, I think, when you have that frame, it changes your tactics.
Exactly.
And because I'm a humanist, I believe that there's beauty in every person. And some people, it's under a layer of sludge, but it's there. And so I think our goal should be to take the opportunity to educate. So I think you're doing exactly the right thing. And this is a perfect transition to talk about leadership in these kind of spaces. So how rhetorically and tactically have you thought about ways to encourage farmers to think about their land in a 500-year time scale rather than a 5-year time scale? Because stewardship is a big thing mm-hmm. for organizations, and farmers are dealing with debt and loans and the next crop cycle, and they're not thinking about what's my soil going to be like for the people that are here half 500 years from now?
Jordan, I really appreciate this question because I just saw something earlier today on social media saying that the farmer, the gardener is inherently a futurist because you've got to have an inherent sort of like trust in tomorrow to plant some seeds in the first place. And the ways that some of the like impacts of our system may crimp one's ability to expand their concept of time in that way is very heartbreaking in a lot of ways. And so some of the things I talk to farmers with on a regular basis is a lot of their framing is within less than even 5 years. It's really 1 year. So even just thinking about like the movement towards creating more agroforestry spaces or more food forests in opposition to food deserts and food apartheid. And there's this like ideological desire, of course, to think of one's space in the next seven generations. And I think that because of some of the limitations to land access, that is one of the biggest issues that stops farmers from being able to think 500 years into the future. Because they're like, well, I can only think right now because based on my business plan, I know I need to make X amount of money. So that means I need to grow X amount of pounds, which means I need to plant X amount of rows.
Yeah.
So I'm right here. I've got tunnel vision. And so part of my org's vision, mission, and values are in increasing access to land and increasing access to the right now resources that alleviate some of that urgency so that those conversations could be had. Because just as much as we were talking about like the ease that that lends itself to creating villains in a story, or there's also the complexities of sometimes people need to be invited into being able to have a conversation that they didn't know was even possible, or a future that they didn't know was possible. And there's some massaging, there's some chewing on a concept that has to happen for folks to even, they may be introduced to a concept once and be like, I don't know about that. I don't have time to think about that.
Yeah.
But given some leeway or touch on it a year from now, they're like, you know what? Maybe I could think about that now, actually.
Yeah, having those mind-expanding conversations. There's a great book by William McCaskill, I think is his name. And he's a philosopher, and his book is called What We Owe the Future. And it's getting you to think in those big time scales because it's hard for people. But if you think ethically about if you did something that could cause a lot of future generations to suffer, that's a lot of people. And if we think about climate change, that could affect hundreds of millions and billions of people by decisions we make now. And so I think a lot of us need to be thinking in those terms. Now, speaking of thinking on bigger scales, I know you were a fellow at the Institute of Urban and Regional Development. Mm-hmm. How do you think your involvement there affected the way change?
It affected the way that I see change because this idea of urban planning, it doesn't only affect urban spaces. And it made me think a lot about the distinction between urban and rural and how time can shift that definition. Even as someone coming from LA, honestly, like I had never come to Fresno until 2020. And I'd only driven through it, and I didn't really fully understand the context of what the Central Valley in California meant. And so saying that, because when I was a fellow at IURD, I was reading a lot of documents and definitely a lot of clerical work, and also working with an environmental lawyer who we worked on cases to develop like cultural space in Oakland. That one is called the Black Cultural Zone, which now is flourishing in the community. And what it made me realize was just how, I don't remember the quote right now, but there's that concept of just a small group of people who care about something can move forward some element of change in a way that if nobody was caring about it, or if you had a big company that might try to smite you down. This small group was dedicated to saying, hey, we need this space. We need this focus so that way we can engage in our environment in different capacity. And so I feel like there was this like meta conversation of this institute here at UC Berkeley is doing all these studies for like over hundreds of years. And here I am, this student that the fellowship was maybe a year, and being able to like understand my positionality, learning from those folks, the staff at in the department and the lawyer who was part of my fellowship. And now fast forwarding to how I'm in connection with that Black cultural zone that I helped establish to a certain degree. So it gave me this like a drop in the bucket. Like it still creates ripples and waves, even though I felt like my role may not have been very significant, it still makes a difference. And so change, big or small, is still change. And that leads me to just Octavia Butler's parable of the sower, and change is God in that way. Like it's the only thing that's going to keep happening is change in some way, shape, or form. And how we decide to give it meaning, how we decide to polarize it or charge it or not, it still happens.
One of the organizations that you're deeply involved in is the Butterfly Movement, which is a fantastic organization that's building up women and girls and empowering them. In looking through your mission and some of your goals, there's a big emphasis put on identity development. Why is that as important or more important than just giving people skills? There's a lot of organizations that are just trying to do upskilling without doing the complementary kind of like formation, human formation. Yeah. Why for you is it so important to do identity formation work?
I feel like it's a big assumption to think that if I give someone a tool that they're going to know how to use it within the context of who they are. For example, in one of our programs in Sankofa Gardens, we help people build their gardens at their homes. And then we also have a local school farm called Castlemont Farm and Gardens, where we host gatherings where those families and other community members come and learn skills together while we're pouring into the community farm and learning together. And then we go back to our homes and do our things there. And there was a young girl who I've watched grow up now, and she was having such a time with this shovel. She saw all the adults using the shovel the way that you're quote unquote supposed to use a shovel. And so she was picking up the shovel and trying to use it. But obviously in this case, the shovel is way bigger than her. So she's like grunting and grinding, determined to use this shovel the way that she assumes it's supposed to be used. And meanwhile, we were like definitely like uplifting her desire to like support in the work. But also we were like, we need some kid shovels. Because why does she have to work 10 times harder to just lift this thing when we can just get a tool that's appropriate for her? And she, at that moment, may not have had the language to be like, actually, I need a shovel that is built for my body. And so then it becomes this like identity development and self-esteem development is really critical for us to know how to ask for what we need based on knowing ourselves and what, like, and the things that we need change based on the cycles and systems that we're involved in. But at the end of the day, like, it's hard for anyone else to know what you need if you don't tell them or you don't have a system for indicating it, which is through that identity development, having other tools like consistent feedback loops and check-ins are a critical component there. Because yes, no one can read each other's minds, but there's also this like synergy that also sometimes happens when you're working with communities, that when there's like the same people in a group, we get to know each other a little more just by having consistent touch points. I can see you through different seasons and make an educated guess on some of the things you might need. But that comes from experience and like consistent touch points. And so even just knowing how you receive information, knowing how you receive feedback, all those things determine how you're able to engage in this larger concept of community, which is complex.
So that kind of work is having a huge impact on people's lives. but it's also challenging if you were to go to a funder and say, here is the scope of my impact, because you're telling stories, right? And that's a different kind of measurement tool than I've worked in nonprofit spaces. They want measurables or those kinds of things. So when you're looking at organizations that are attacking complex problems that are not, that often rely on qualitative data, mm-hmm. quantitative data in that respect, how do you evaluate impact?
I like this question because I think that the problem is the solution in terms of changing the metrics of success. And although there are people, entities that are going to challenge like the viability or the success rate of a story, like, oh, that's not really quantitative. Like, how do you assess? And it's, you can talk, you get testimonials. And I think that it forces us to also see that as true value and also, yeah, having that documentation present. And I've been grateful to work with funders and people who are starting to see that more as a valid way of assessment so that it doesn't become this thing where I'm trying to force anyone to see what we're doing as important. I think that a lot of funders are becoming more keen to taking these other metrics of success into consideration so that we don't have to do as much heavy lifting and we can still remain authentic to ourselves. And granted, it's not a very like prolific shift yet, but I don't think that it goes back to that same thing of change. Like, it takes one funder at a time. And we've just been also blessed to work with folks who like believe in what we're doing and don't make us have to jump through a ton of hoops to get the supports that we need.
Last question is kind of topic area. How do you think about the trade-offs between professionalizing grassroots organizing? If you professionalize, sometimes you can increase your impact. Mm-hmm. Professionalization leads to that. But then sometimes you get mission creep because you get professionalization in there and then they start to question, is that actually a value? So how do you think about those trade-offs when you're approaching leading an organization?
I think that I put the same, that feedback loop process is very necessary when it comes to this topic because there are pros and cons, obviously. And if you let something run too far in one direction, it can be very easy to be like, oh no, now we're only focusing on this, or now we have to build our programs to the grant that we applied to and we can't really backtrack because our funds are determined on us doing that, which then you're like, what do we get into this for? And I think that's, to me, a very making sure that like your board, making sure that like the people who are making decisions, the people who are governing the entity have some of these checks and balances embedded in the fabric of the organization, so that way there's not really a huge threat of things snowballing into something that is untenable. I think that when you move too fast, one thing that the founder of the Butterfly Movement, her name is Brandy Mack, one thing she always says is haste is waste. Because in my opinion, and from what I've seen and from what we've even spoken about, that pretty much tracks. So it's in order to make it so that professionalism doesn't deteriorate or dilute the integrity of the work, you need to have these systems in place that are constantly looking back. Like, what's the vision? Sankofaing, as we call it. Let's look back. Let's make sure we're on track. Okay, keep going.
Let me ask you one question about Fresno. How has your vision of and understanding of Fresno changed in the last 3 years?
When I first came here to visit in 2020, I was visiting a group called Building Youth Tomorrow Today. And that group had a program called Watch Us Grow, where they were working specifically with youth around growing food and learning about nutrition. And so they worked with African-American farmers of California at their demonstration site and were hosting nutrition courses for youth. And so that was my entrance into this space. And since then, I would come back periodically to Fresno to visit that group and work with the folks there, also bring them to other site visits in the Bay Area. And so when I decided to come out here in 2023, it was based on the relationships that I had built with that community. And I had started farming on a sublet piece of land in Carruthers. Now, I say that I got hazed into Fresno just because that summer, it was like 114.
I remember that all the summer, yeah.
And I was like, is this not Nobody told me it was like
At least you didn't get bait and switched. Could have been worse.
True. Exactly. Yeah. I'm like,
you're like, oh, it's mild here. And then the next summer, it's hellscape. Yeah.
I was like, okay, cool. So from then, I was like, if I can survive this, then I'll figure out the rest of the time. And since then, I feel like my perception of Fresno, I get a lot of questions like, you're from LA? You lived in the Bay? Like, why are you in Fresno? And I always thought that was an interesting framing for me, because obviously I don't have a context of growing up here. Yeah. But I've since been able to meet many people who have grown up here, them telling me stories of them as kids, like riding around almond orchards and just this way of life that to me sounded very much some of the movies that I might have watched.
For sure.
And I was like, that's so interesting, like the kind of lifestyle that they were used to versus like now how I'm experiencing this place that was once considered rural and is now considered urban. I think that I know that there's a lot of growth that has happened here, and there's a lot of people from LA and the Bay that have also come here due to rising housing costs, because that was one of the main reasons why I came here.
Yeah.
I wanted to own a home in California, and when I looked at where to go, I was like, I commute often to LA and the Bay. I have family in both places, so it kind of just made sense. Yeah, Central Valley.
Yeah. And you did choose a beautiful neighborhood to come into.
Exactly.
So we close each of these podcasts with book recommendations. A few books you'd like to recommend to listeners.
I'm going to go back to Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler. Sci-fi for me, as I'm a huge sci-fi nerd, and I think that sci-fi is a really important tool to help people take real world issues and bring them into some semblance of fiction.
I will ride and die with Bloodchild all day. It is one of my favorite stories. And when I used to be teaching, I was a teacher for a decade. I would occasionally test the class out. Could you handle this? Mm-hmm. Bloodchild is no joke.
Yeah.
And if they could, I was like, all right, I'm about to show you some shit now, kids.
Yeah.
So anyway, I love Octavia. And I lived in Altadena. So it's
exactly. So that one, and then Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperation, or Collectives and Cooperatives by Natasha Bowers. That book is really critical for me as someone that does a lot of like collective and collaborative works, because I think I know that we live in a system that sometimes puts a lot of like emphasis on us as individuals going hard at it, like the American dream, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, blah, blah, blah. And ultimately, we can't really do a lot of the things that we do without each other. However, how do we do that in ways that also uplift us as communities versus trauma bonding or...
I've never done that once.
Right. And so just it gives a nice anthology of different organizations that have been working together towards this goal of how can we support each other, especially if we know that we need help, and what are the systems that we can put in place to allow our lives to just be a little easier, and knowing that it is a journey, that it takes longer than just trying to do it all by yourself. And I think that if more of us take that into consideration and do the personal work that allows us to open up to do that collective work, reading books like this can offer just some great stories and little pathways towards getting that deeper, doing some of that massaging to understand, like, what's the importance of collective and cooperative works.
What about, and this doesn't have to be a book, but educational tool, like if you want to start homesteading, getting into permaculture at home. And I found books helpful sometimes. Sometimes I felt like I needed someone to, like, walk with me on that journey. What resources would you recommend for those areas?
I would first start with looking into your local community garden, just because I think that a lot of local community garden spaces offer workshops and even just moments where you can talk to someone who is working in the soil. And oftentimes, like, that first step can open the floodgates to a ton of other resources, like in your area. Like I work with the Fresno Horticulture Club.
There's the Master Gardener Association. There's so many of them. Yeah,
exactly. Sure. So
even a nursery. Even yeah. A nursery can give you some perspective on what kinds of plants will thrive in your
exactly.
particular system.
Yeah.
All right. So if people are interested in finding out more about you and your work mm-hmm. and they go to find your stuff.
I would go to www.thebutterflymovement.com. Also www.farmerjustice.com. Also, I'm on Instagram at Walker of the Sky. That's spelled WALKROFTHESKEYE.
Perfect. So what is next for you? What projects are on the horizon you're excited about?
I'm really excited. We're planning for a 2027 summit for Farmer Justice, and we're basically spreading the word now because we like to take our time and build connections with communities intentionally. We're working with some amazing folks in the Bay Area and in the Central Valley around like food hub development and just like taking our time, learning what people need at such a very interesting moment in history. So doing a lot of outreach and being in the field with people in the soil.
Awesome. Oh, Minka, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you too, Jordan. Fresno's best.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's best. We'll see you next time.